The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and/or print impaired. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the New Yorker Hour on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm Evan Mercer, and today I'll be reading from the January 21st, 2019 edition of the New Yorker magazine. I'll read a short story by Salvatore Scribona, followed by an essay on decision-making. Do we make the big decisions, or do they make us? So today I'll start with a short story entitled Do Not Stop by Salvatore Scribona. Okinawa was a fever dream of mosquitoes and Falstaff beer. A Marine Corps rule said that they couldn't put Volley on the plane to deploy if he was too drunk to walk unassisted across the tarmac and up the stairs into the bird. Why did command make a rule like that if they were going to give you liberty to see the town the night before you flew out? A buddy he'd met stateside in survival training, a ranch hand from New Mexico, was teaching Volley to drink himself sick. The belly got to get swole up, his companion said. Loose that belt. Let the bubbles in down deep. You're a beer camel now. They'll put me on that plane in 10 pieces is the only way. Tie me together in a cargo in the cargo hold. We used to keep camels on the ranch, 2 of them. Brother, they could drink up the whole irrigation ditch. See now, the way you doing, either breathing or drinking, that there is a mistake. You got to keep up breathing while the beer goes down. He had a head full of cuspate teeth, and when he snored on the bunk, his eyes opened, showing only the grisly whites while the irises pointed elsewhere inside the skull. His name was Bobby Heflin. They headed to a different bar. Everywhere in the street, people were trying to sell them laundry detergent, beer and cigarettes by the case, shaving products, all the brands of home in bright, familiar packaging with the power to transport Volley back to what already seemed a precious previous life. Long afternoons under the lift in the dank garage, where a transistor sang catchy odes to gum and window cleaners, and he timed the turns of a ratchet to the rhythm of the jingle beat. They got to the new bar. Volley took a seat at a long plank table where some squids were playing bridge, concentrated in an insular and leaning back to hide their cards amid the narrow quarters of the table like a crowded raft. Heflin went away for more beers. Then, back on the Okinawan street, and everybody trying to sell Volley more detergent. Tide, the wash day miracle. Cleanest washes you can get. Winston, the filter blend that makes the big taste difference. Falstaff, beer that satisfies your taste for living. A C-141 came in low enough you could see the light warping behind its engines and a red cross painted on its tail fin, so its cargo would be what? Casualties, he figured. Get the package with the spear and you'll know enjoyment's here because it's Wrigley's here, the biggest little treat in all the land. All this while, he stumbled in streets lit beautiful as yards at Christmas, every moment more beautiful as the tropical dusk settled in and the neon red lights everywhere invited him into establishments with silhouettes of what he had learned was a martini glass. You could also buy a squatting ape carved out of a hollowed coconut with a slot in its mouth for your spare change. You saved your money like that instead of blowing it on beer and trinkets to send to your folks, who had no need of conch shells that carried home the sound of the saucing sea. His folks were on a farm in Calamus, Iowa, too old to work the place on their own, but he had left them there, as though forgotten. He had volunteered. Volley led Heflin toward a cocktail lounge. Or maybe it was the other way around. Heflin led Volley, or the other way, both of them led by the red neon figure of a martini glass suspended above the establishment's door. The place inside swarmed with Marines. You'd think an invasion was on. Skinny, pimpled white, black, laughing idiots, eager to get mowed down to the ankles, reaped like corn. Heflin had gone away again because here he was coming back with two fresh cans. "Give me your life," he shouted. Except it was knife, he'd said, and he turned the beers upside down and stabbed them on the bottom and showed how to cover the hole, then flip it right side up, crack the top, slip the tab into the can, and shoot the beer. All this Volley did, but the beer tasted wrong. His can had halfway drained, the logo lion's head leering, before it became clear the discombobulating foreignness of the beer consisted in its being hot beer, hot as blood. And then the can was empty. Falstaff, the choicest product of the brewer's art, and Heflin howling like a spanked dog, and Volley felt a baseball bat smack him in the eyes. Hold on, it was only the hot beer like a blow to the head. A girl, a perfect Japanese girl with shiny clothes, came by with a tray of Singapore slings and said, "Your job is to die," except inflected like a question. "The hell it is," he said. She repeated, "You want to buy?" "Yes." "And how?" "Another for his buddy?" "Yes, for the cowboy, too." "Look at his shark teeth." "Don't kiss him. Your mouth will get stuck in there." And the girl went away. If you were under the influence, they weren't supposed to put you on the plane. It bewildered him, the motliness of what you could buy from a single market stall. Only he was pretty sure he was still inside the cocktail place and only thinking about the market stalls flanking the street outside. All the products of home, though he was in Japan, and also face paint, magazines, hi-fis, porno, decals extolling the honor of the 3rd Marine Division, the Fighting 3rd, all for sale from the same codgers in the street. No distinctions whatever to clarify what you were supposed to buy from the one stall rather than the other, which was too confusing, and that was why he wanted to go back under the neon silhouette of the cocktail glass into the lounge, because the silhouette of the cocktail glass clarified things, made it plain what you were supposed to do in there. Except if he was looking at the sign, he was outside. And how was he outside? He actually was outside, after all, because his drink was inside, so he went back in there. He sat on a high chair, and another shiny girl, a penumbra of light around her like a saint in a picture, wearing a brilliant, vertically striped dress like pulled taffy with a fluorescent light rod stuck in it. She glowed so. Approached him carrying a tray of plastic tumblers, red and frothy with straws, and a quarter round of pineapple clipping the lip of the drinks, and asked, "Would he like a long beverage?" Later, he would remember the chair, a spindle-backed chair that turned on ball bearings. He would remember he was sitting in this chair, taking the plastic drink from the shiny girl, then not being greedy with the pineapple slice, taking only the one bite to avoid the sneaky pricks of pine that hid in the flesh. And he would remember he had yet to pay the girl and turned in the chair with a dollar in his fist, lest she vanish before she could be paid. A sudden swinging turn that swept the chair from under him, and the very next thing, no time elapsed at all, a perfect glue or weave between the days, the very next thing there's a voice, a staticky voice over an intercom saying, "Gentlemen, fasten your seatbelts, you are landing in the Republic of Vietnam." You'd see a guy was scared. They were all of them scared out of their minds, even while stoned. But you'd see what it was. It the eyes too open, too reactive to movement, or the glint of the sun on passing scooter windshields. Eyes too certain they could see it coming, the moment, the fell turn. A crouchy way of moving around even when the guy had no gear to hump. And it all amounted to a greed to go on living, laced with the knowledge it was not to be. Like, "I know I ain't getting out of here." And then a few weeks later, you'd hear that guy was dead. There wasn't any sense to make of this phenomenon. Unless God didn't like you expecting too much and he punished you for it by giving you what you expected to get. And you might think, all right, then I'll go ahead and expect to make it home. But that was just vanity. No available facts supported such a foolish assurance. Within a week of Volley's arrival in the country, he was picking shards of the head of a lance corporal off his shirt. A boy nearly his same age and hair attached to the shards that smelled of smoke and Brill cream. You'd see a guy stop short three times while trying the same shoe. Stop to look up at a moonlight flicking off a rock while the river moved on it. Stop and look. Stop and look. And a month later, that guy would be dead. The lesson was, anything you love so bad that everywhere you look you see how you're going to lose it, that thing will be taken from you, even your life. So Volley had a mantra. He had learned to meditate from Bobby Heflin, of all unquiet people, who'd read some magazine articles about Buddhism and a Buddhist all-eclipsing indifference to property, to life, to limb. Volley had a mantra, and he sat still in the dark in his bunk, with his back against the plywood hooch wall at Dong Ha, with his eyes half closed, with his folded feet aflame from fungal itching, and he breathed deep and said within the mind, "It don't mean nothing. It don't mean nothing." Into his consciousness came a vision of how he would lose his hand, the right hand, which played the melody on the Baldwin upright back home, and he said without speaking, "It don't mean nothing." Not that the fear didn't mean anything, or the vision of the pain, but the hand didn't mean anything. Then the vision of reaching into a hole in the ground, a hidden tunnel entrance, with the left hand, the harmony hand, reaching into the ground in the jungle, knowing the VC had a whole world of interconnected tunnels, whole supply channels underground. A whole division might be waiting then there to bite off the hand, so why was he doing this? But he was doing it in the vision, and saw with lightning clarity the hole explode, and the fire leaping out of it, and his own blood spitting on his face, and these two stumps at the ends of his arms, like when a kid walks on the road in winter without gloves and bunches up the fists within the cuffs. Except the hands were not hidden. Melody and harmony, they were gone. And of the hands, he said crisply in his mind, "They don't mean nothing." And he saw his silver-headed father sneezing in the hog barn, ailing in his bed, and said, "It don't mean nothing." Meanwhile, meaning he didn't mean anything, the aging man at home, the red peeling face awaiting Volley's return. And he saw the farm with only his mother working it. It didn't mean nothing. Cracked drain tile clogged with earth that made the meadow flood. It didn't mean nothing. The apple trees unsprayed and the fruit eaten to pulp by curculios. It didn't mean nothing. And he got up and went into a tent where a couple of dirt-caked convoy drivers lay on cots asleep in front of a TV showing a police movie. All sirens and shadows and waxy hair. The unsteady horizontal hold on the black and white screen, catching the moment, the scene, and losing it. And the scene running away like a loose blind, and then catching it again. Shadows, and then glowing white human faces close to the camera. And Lauren Bacall looked out of the convex box into the night that reeked of monsoon funk with lust and reproach in her face as if to say, "I dare you to forget me, too." The country had been on fire from the moment he first landed. He'd only ever seen a big civilian city from the inside of planes or airports, and now he was outside on the tarmac, in his undressed blues, and carrying a sea bag, and the uncountable Falstaffs and Singapore slings were exacting their revenge on his head and guts. In a city, Da Nang, that was home to hundreds of thousands and was taking artillery fire, smoke rising like giant ghost trees from the rooftops. Within a couple of hours, he was assigned to the 26th Marines at a supply depot in the rear at Dong Ha, from which he was to run convoys up the dirt roads to the forward combat bases near the DMZ at Camp Carroll, Lang Vi, Quang Tri, something called the Rock Pile and another spot that was just an airstrip, really, as it turned out, a road, a cliff, and an airstrip on a low plateau outside a village called Quezon. Although whatever human life in the village had been raptured lately, right before he passed through it the first time, so lately the cats were still delicately eating scraps in the hot trash heaps, the cats, the souls of the sinners left behind. Convoy orders were nice and simple. Keep going. A long line of trucks in single file. 20, 50, sometimes 100 trucks. You get a flat tire, you keep going. He drove an M54, a 5-ton truck with 10 wheels. And you could lose a tire as long as it wasn't in the front and keep on up the slick road to the combat base. A truck disabled by whatever mechanical failure or landmine, you ditch that truck and keep going. If it obstructs the road, you push it off the cliff. Don't matter if your mother's inside. Do not stop. They were running candy canes and powder charges and everything in between. Building supplies, shovels, canned milk. But the cargo and any disabled truck could be replaced. 2 minutes stopped on a mountain road was plenty long enough for a convoy to get sighted and blown to hell from incoming. Squads of grunts were guarding the road, on patrol or dug in, or some of them hiding in rock formations, because up near the DMZ, the place could have been Mars for all the cover any vegetation provided. But you hardly saw these dug-in or hiding squads and fire teams until you were right on top of them. And while the convoy headed back to Dong Ha the afternoon after a drop, the grunts guarding the road would throw a bag into your truck as you drove by. A bag or polypropylene woven bag, usually used for sandbagging, but with a rock in it to make it like sail like a projectile. And you'd snatch it coming in your window. Inside was a passel of rumpled lists of the supplies they needed. Razor blades, rations, bullets, cigarettes, soap. Somebody wrote, chicken soup or orange juice. We all got colds. It was Christmas every day, and Vali was Santa Claus taking requests. Every list pleaded for beer, but he couldn't find any for the longest times. Sometimes the roadside grunts put mail in the sandbags along with the rock and the rumpled list, and if they were dug in far enough from the road, you had to square up high on the mount atop the cab, where Vali often manned a 50-caliber machine gun to snag the thing from the air like a long fly to the outfield, and inside was a letter to Mr. and Mrs. Stanley Rottenberg of Livonia, Michigan, and a rumpled note to the convoy demanding, if not beer, at least a couple of 100 pounds of grass. All Vali had for them to drink was Coca-Cola. It turned out some guys made a casserole out of rations cooked in Coke. A Puerto Rican from the 2-9 Marines told him that was how you were supposed to cook pork, which was comical, trying to tell a Clinton County boy he didn't know how to cook a pig. There were whole villages made of Coke cases, and the ingenious Vietnamese had pleated together roofs for their huts out of the dissected Coke cans. The convoy had to slow up through one such village, and they should have known better because as they rolled into the village, no kids were flinging themselves at the sides of the trucks, begging for candy and rations. Everybody was in a hut someplace. And then a bomb detonated in the road. A Marine artillery shell most likely that had failed to explode and had been rejiggered into a landmine. The mine blew off the front end of the truck right ahead of Ollie's. Three men flew up and away from the explosion, but they still had their legs and scrambled, flesh hanging in strips through smoldering fatigues. The automatic Marine body that scrambles before it understands into the back of Ollie's truck. The convoy plowed, teetering right over the cardboard village, right over the Coke can huts, crushing who knew what, rice bags or people, under the listing axles, and the convoy did not stop. It got to Camp Carroll, ahead of schedule, carrying mail, tents, diesel fuel, kerosene, Winston, the one filter cigarette that delivers flavor 20 times a pack, two wounded, and one dead. He was Santa Claus and the mailman and a teenager driving tons of munitions through a monsoon slick road in early February with rat-a-tat-tat sniper fire in the distant hills as normal as bird songs. Winston's got that filter flavor. Then back in Dong Ha, he found the Quonset hut where the squids were hiding their beer. If Marines never stole from the Army and the Navy, we could never win a war. A Marine is a thief by training, tradition, and necessity caused by, why are we always out of supplies and they're so flush? Another Marine from his convoy group lit a smoke bomb at the far end of the depot, and the squids went running to investigate while Volley backed up his truck to the Quonset hut, and with a dolly, a ramp, and four men pushing, they got a whole pallet of Ham's beer into his truck and covered it. And he was out of there before the quartermaster or anybody else was any the wiser. Clean cut, with smoothness aged in, Ham's, it's the refreshingest. Then, the whole way to the rock pile, they threw warm cases of beer down to the men popping from behind boulders, from under makeshift blinds, men joyous as retriever dogs to see the labels on the cases. His convoy had nearly reached the rock pile midday when a Marine appeared, like a vision hovering above the road in the distance. At first, it seemed the warm beer was giving Volley hallucinations, but he'd only drunk that one, nice and slow to let the stomach take it. Not even the one, a swig remained in the can he held with fingers that meantime guided the steering wheel. The Marine wore a painted wooden sign around his neck. You could see his busted helmet and flak jacket, but the feet were too loose to be standing. He floated midair, a miracle, a Marine with invisible wings. And then as the truck got close, you could see the spike that had been introduced through his rear end and into his torso, a thin spike you spied only when you were near enough to see his face. In fact, a dead Vietnamese face, about 15 years old, with flies nesting in the nose, dressed in the old shreds of Marine fatigues. The sign around his neck read, "Caution! This road patrolled by the magnificent bastards, 2nd Battalion, 4th Marines," and a little drawing of a seahorse for a signature. They slept that night at the rock pile, or anyhow under it. There wasn't any need to drive up the crazy mountain or any road to climb it. It didn't seem. And in the morning, they drove back to Dong Ha without stopping, occasionally throwing sea rations of ham and mother effers at the Vietnamese in their loose-fit rags who lined the roads, sometimes begging for food and sometimes pretending to beg for food so you would slow down if you were stupid and they would throw a grenade in your cab. They pulled into Dong Ha, and the grinning, screeching children swarmed, begging frenziedly, and the trucks pushed through with all due haste. Farther along, near the base gate, an old woman, or not so old but without any teeth, the brown smiling gums gone to leather from chewing betel nut, waved her straw cone hat sweet and friendly by the roadside. Suddenly, she bent low and fished at her skirt bottom. Volley unholstered the 1911 pistol from his shoulder, or his hand unholstered it, jutted it out the window, and aimed it. The peaceful, fleet hand that did its work while the laggard mind raced to understand what was happening. Then, the old woman, unfazed by a semi-automatic pistol aimed at her face by a dumb white teenager in a truck, pulled her skirt up over her belly and pulled down her shapeless drawers, calling, "Fidella! Fidella!" His hand drew his pistol back inside the cab. The trucks rumbled on through the gate into the compound, and the men refueled and parked at the tire shop and went to the mess and then to their bunks. He had never seen a woman's privates before. He had seen pictures, and he had dreamed dreams, but the mind, so unswerving in its misguided notions and expectations, could not shake all night the weirdness that the effing part was in the front of her, whereas in the female of all the other animals he could think of, you found the effing parts behind. The frontwardness, the face-to-face aspect of human effing, was itself backwards. But no, that was another lie of the discordant mind. The body didn't know we were made to do things the wrong way. It didn't know this thing that wasn't true. It got an erection all the same to see a woman without her clothes, even a decrepit one, though perhaps the erection came from the pistol he had aimed at her face and had not fired. Ham and Mother Effers was ham and lima beans, and even the starvelings up at Khe San didn't want them. Do not stop the convoy. But then one day, while they were taking apart their pallets at Khe San, uncommon to stop at Khe San, rumors of a hell of a ruckus up there, what with the RPGs and the 130-millimeter guns, so the Marine Corps was supplying mostly from the air, he heard a noise. He was unloading into a hooch, and he heard a noise. He looked around him. The four other guys unloading with him were already gone. He ran out of the tent, aware he was a step behind something important. And the body, knowing Morris, always threw itself in the trench outside the hooch and landed on a dead grunt who... Wait, he was not dead, but crouching, ducked and covered in a stream that... Wait... was not a stream, but a trench filled 2 feet deep with water. The grunt threw volley off him. Volley landed in the water. Six men crouched, half submerged. The sun was setting through the drizzle. I have heard incoming real close, and so I am in a trench, reported the idiot laggard mind, and I am afraid. And then the artillery was everywhere, the surface of the airstrip around him bubbling like a boiling stew, and they stayed in the trench until the sun had set two more times. Somewhere in there he heard a whistle and saw his truck blow up, and he figured he would be here at Khe San a while longer. Lucky he had dismounted his .50 caliber from the truck an hour before the barrage, intending to take her apart and clean and oil her that night and remount her the next morning, when they would have headed home to Dong Ha, sort of making nightly love to her, or, to be honest, not making love, about which he knew only the basic engineering strategy, more like grooming her, getting her ready like a sow before the fair, brushing, greasing. That the .50 caliber had not been destroyed was to prove useful in the 2 months he was stuck at Khe San. Everybody in the convoy who had manned a .50 caliber had a name for it, usually stenciled with spray paint in the mounting plate above the cab. Guns named Winter Night, Mafia Inc. 2, Voss, Shirley. His he named Hog Butcher, and his intimacy with her was such that, some weeks later, when the grunts mounted her atop the sandbags on the morning the NVA finally came at them in person, a crash of figures like ants, innumerable, he almost snatched her down from the trench slip, fearful lest some harm should come to her, and resentful these thieving bastards should touch her. Despite her name and job, he knew that Hog Butcher was a female. He wasn't the only truck driver stuck at Khe San. Once the big assault started, they couldn't get anybody through to sweep the road for mines, and his whole convoy was stranded. Later, no road remained to sweep. Nothing fitting the term appeared to lead from the place. The base was an island in a lake of clay that bubbled with incoming and aerial bombardment. Mortar attacks killed several of the other drivers in the convoy, and he inherited one of their trucks. For weeks, the perimeter of the airfield was bombed and rocketed and napalmed to such an extent that he kind of got used to the noise. He lived on a plateau with a fire surrounding it. His question-asking apparatus having been extracted in boot camp, it didn't occur to him to ask anybody what was out there to bomb so. he couldn't really see what they were trying to hit. It was one driver who asked one of the infantry sergeants what they were bombing. "The enemy, knucklehead," the sergeant said. "Don't you know when you're under siege?" Volley could not see any enemy. He saw earth afire. The enemy was underground. Then there were transport planes, C-130s mostly, the Hercules, supplying them now because evidently no more convoys. But it pleased him the pilots followed the old convoy rule, do not stop. A Hercules sitting still on a landing strip made a plum target, juicier probably than a stopped convoy since the flames would rise higher in the sky if it was hit. If you are too far away to count the number of your enemy dead, how else to measure success but by the height of the flames? So the pilots did this number where the plane flew low over the strip, sometimes low enough to knock off a man's head if he were standing there. Its hatch dropped open in the back, and a grappling hook in the airstrip snagged a loop of cord dangling from the hatch, and the plane kept going. The plane did not stop, but the cord inside was attached to a long succession of supplies on pallets that shot out of the cargo bay and somersaulted as the Hercules cleared the strip, never having touched down. The base was getting shelled incessantly. The airstrip was a mess, and men ran out there to fill the holes with dirt and cover them with steel land matting while new shells made new holes farther up the strip. Meantime, everywhere around him, except a few hills, was under equally endless but much higher flaming aerial bombardment from his own government. Yet he saw no NVA. He did not see mass troops. It was a siege in theory only. And there he was, outside playing basketball with the grunts sometimes. The NVA couldn't mortar every inch of the compound at every minute, so why not get some exercise? And when he couldn't sleep playing George Gershwin or Schumann songs on a mute piano he had made from a sawbuck tabletop and a magic marker, and it got so he could hear the music in his mind, even his mistakes, and steadily improved with his perverse way of playing piano. Music minus sound, leaving only the boy's body at peace, in articulate motion, alive and in time to the moving numbers that measure and govern everything from Schumann to jet propulsion and the pressure of the blood in your arteries. And he boiled rations over stoves made of old tuna cans filled with dirt and gasoline. And he was probably going to die. They would be overrun, and it didn't mean nothing. Then it was dark, late February. The Puerto Rican Espinosa had got hold of a pint of bourbon and shared it with Volley, who had never drunk bourbon or any sort of whiskey. It tasted like Coke, boiled to a gravy and cut with lighter fluid. He feared to smoke as he drank, lest he catch fire. Espinosa sometimes appeared to be scratching his privates through his pocket while working a sunflower seed in his lips. In fact, he kept a rosary in the pocket and was mumbling prayers. He carried on this way even while they drank bourbon and played cards late at night in Volley's tent. It was about 2 a.m. when they had emptied the bottle, and Espinosa got up to head back to his tent by the ammunition depot. But a minute later, he came back saying he couldn't see his hand in front of his face out there in the dark and the fog. So Volley cleared sleeping room for him in the tent, and his makeshift caisson home on the dirt off the airstrip, which was really, the tent was, well, really nothing more than a half tent made from a parachute pegged to the dirt on one side and tied up to the door of his new truck on the other. And Volley fell into dreamless, inebriate sleep. Then he woke up yelling, "It hit me! It hit me!" Espinosa could be heard wrestling with the tent walls, tearing the top edge of the thing away from the truck, unable in the total dark of foggy, moonless night to see the flap of the enclosure. The side Volley kept open to let the breeze in, and through which shrapnel had just evidently flown and drilled his face, his arms, his throat. "It hit me," Volley said, the splatter somehow soft. It was so warm. He couldn't move or see. Unaccountably, he had been hit only in the parts of him his fatigues didn't cover. If he couldn't get out of here, it was probably because his legs didn't work. It hit me, he said to nothing and no one, and looked down to where his feet ought to be, but saw nothing. However, it was dark. Mind and body at last rendezvoused, and he sent his foot a message, speaking it aloud to pull all his parts on, to put all his parts on notice to attend. I'll stop my foot, and if I hear it, then it's still there. The muscles of the upper leg then contracted, and a low, quiet, peaceful stamp sounded amid the nylon of the tent, enveloping him like a shroud. He convened, likewise, with the other foot. Outside, Espinosa said, "Who the hell are you talking to? Get under the effing truck, man!" He wasn't hit. Bali wasn't. Not exactly. Mud had splattered his face, neck, and arms. A shell or a rocket had exploded near Bly and blasted the mud through the opening of the tent. He discovered this under the truck. Itself, not the soundest of places to hide from a barrage. A couple of artillery flashes gave them a visual notion of how to make it to the trench. They bolted for the perimeter. The entire interval, waking up believing he was hit, the experiment with his feet, the communing of mind with lower extremities, sliding under the truck and hustling out to the perimeter and down into the trench with grunts already in their firing, had taken about as long as it takes to butter up a piece of toast. The grunts in the trench had mounted the hog butcher on sandbags, and they were firing her. They had already used all but one box of the ammunition at hand, but Vali had stolen and hidden about 20 boxes from a Hercules drop he had helped unload. Stolen because that is what a Marine does, and secreted them in a hooch about 50 yards away, under a case of toilet paper, and he jumped out of the trench and darted top speed at the hooch, which, under the circumstances, seemed as far away as Egypt. He ran fast, every step a stroke of wild luck. He turned a corner. In another artillery flash, the hooch appeared low and dark through smoke. He had never run faster, but somebody had cut down a dead tree for firewood, leaving the stump 3 feet off the ground, and he struck it at a sprint right in his privates. He convulsed and screamed as though hit again, but he wasn't hit this time. Either not for real. He'd rammed his nuts into a tree. A parting of the smoke and something like dawn light coming over the mountain. And he made it to the hooch and overturned to the toilet paper, they call them sweet rolls, gathered 3 ammunition boxes and hobbled in his nut-crumpled state, expecting to be hit and then to explode with all the rounds in his arms. And he was going as fast as he could, his eyes on the destination, the trench, to get behind the sandbags. But higher up, going on solid ground and running backward toward the perimeter with the dawnish light, he had another vantage than before. And the light better, one of the boxes threatening to fall, and he tried to keep his eyes on the trench to get back there. But he had this other vantage now, and his eyes looking up, squinted against the smoke, and that was when he saw them. He had seen VC before, guerrillas, and he had seen shells coming and the 122-millimeter rockets, but now he saw the enemy themselves, the true enemy out of the burrows, the NVA massed and swarming on human legs. They were like ants, the way ants swarmed over a dead animal in the meadow, except they were all running this way. A few had made it near enough already where you could see their shirts crisscrossed with bandoliers. And the laggard mind said, "Hold on, these people over there want to kill me." All this in the 2 seconds before he got his head and his boxes down below the line of sandbags. He crouched. His privates screamed in pain. The grunt who had commandeered the hog butcher switched with him and got low to feed the machine her bullets from the new boxes, while Vali manned the machine, the hog butcher, who was in actual fact an anti-aircraft weapon that, to fire directly on human beings, violated some article of the Geneva Conventions. Well, so said the scuttlebutt. 5 rounds. Pause. 5 rounds. paws, microscopic bits of the land in her barrel flying out her muzzle, and the red tracer streaming like links of glowing rope of fire, fast at first and then slow and peaceful in the deeper distance, and then careening off at sharp angles when they hit a rock, or, for all he knew, some kid's brain bucket. His helmet, a kid whose tracers were coming right back at Volley reciprocally, but the NVA tracers were green across the low, almost night sky, a field of arcing and suddenly careening red and green tracers, four invisible rounds between every tracers, the colors like Christmas lights, and the hog butcher jammed. She jammed. He opened her from the top. It was like a vivisection. He had to use his asbestos gloves. She was so hot she could take off his skin if he touched her. And he dumped a bottle of 30-weight motor oil all over her innards and her exposed chamber and closed her up. And the grunt refed the chain of long cartridges and remounted her. And Volley went back to firing. Like ants or a tide, and the tracers came rocketing out of the barrel, hot and red like wishes that seemed to slow as they sailed further away. Tracers that sometimes took a sharp upward or outward turn, like wishes gone wrong when the tracer hit a rock or a helmet or another bullet. Amid the profusion of rounds, five times as numerous as were visible and ricocheted. And he saw some of the people convulse, falling backward through the tracer fire. They were coming fast, and Volley was near enough the command post to hear a radio man cranking the phone and calling out coordinates. Do not stop the convoy. Other scuttlebutt said command had started the rumor about the Geneva Conventions to save money on the big, expensive 50-caliber cartridges. He aimed his weapon at the tide, the tracers like wishes or seed corn you scattered away from yourself and that disappeared into some place you couldn't see. It was a wish because you sent it out of you, but you couldn't know what it would come of it. The machine sent a shockwave of recoil through all his bones. One, two, three, four, five, pause. One, two, three, four, five, pause. He ducked down to help unload another box of ammunition and asked the grunt, "Who's he calling?" meaning the radio man. "New Jersey, I guess." Well, that was a joke. The radio man calling the prestigious state back east where Volley's mother had once gone for a cousin's wedding and come back with a picture book about skyscrapers for her boy. However, it was neither a joke nor a state. The grunt said, "Nah, man, the ship." The battleship, a recommissioned dreadnought, the New Jersey, with 16-inch guns revamped and rumored to be out of dry dock in Philadelphia and headed this way. Volley fired and fired continuously and yet resignedly, what with the numbers, the ants, they were about to be overrun. Do not stop the convoy, and he kept firing. Then it was as if somebody as far away as Davenport had fired a cannon at the barn in Calamus and hit it square in the roof, and hit it again. Right where the ants were swarming, there was a shockwave and a wall of fire, and clouds that rose in columns and bloomed flowers of ash, dirt, and smoke. Espinosa ran to the hutch and came back with more ammunition for the hog butcher. Volley kept firing, turning to his left and right like a radio dial. Those must have been the shells coming from the New Jersey. You heard them shearing the air overhead, and then a shockwave and a cloud. Impossible magic, as if an object could have knowledge. The shells coming from afar in the sea and landing right where the radio man had directed them. It took less than 10 minutes for the phantoms to fly the 100 miles from Da Nang. All down the long NVA lines, the enemy were swarming and firing, and the shells blew them up, and phantoms flew low, dropping napalm on the people. And more 16-inch shells came from the New Jersey or wherever, hissing by and detonating almost at once. His orders were not to stop the convoy. He looked behind him. His second truck wasn't there. Mother Effers had driven off with his truck. No, they hadn't. The truck was that pile of twisted, smoking steel, rubber, and canvas. He had lost a second truck. Each truck cost about what the farm cost, and he had lost two of them. Nobody had told him what any of this, the airstrip, the siege, the bombardment, was for. When he got back to Dong Ha after it was over, an Easter card waited for him with his mother's signature in it, alongside his father's mark, and a $2 bill, an old bill dated 1953, but crisp. She had ironed it. Well, I'm sorry, but we don't have enough time left for the essay on decision-making. So instead, I'll read from the critics session an article entitled The Bad Place, How the Idea of Hell Has Shaped the Way We Think, by Vincent Cunningham. This article has been edited for length to fit our time slot. The further from childhood I get, the fewer people I meet who worry about or even believe in what Scott G. Bruce, the editor of a new and quite terrifying compilation, The Penguin Book of Hell, calls the punitive afterlife. But the hell here on earth, the one that preachers promised would lose in the end, hasn't gone anywhere. You might even notice a slight uptick these days in its invocation. As a metaphor for global warming, hellfire is almost too on the nose. There are the grim jokes about how during our most recent and most wretched presidential election, we all surely died and boarded the first elevator downstairs where we are now in permanent residence. Search Twitter for the phrase, "We are literally in hell," and let the scenarios wash over you. It's not only the liberals and the environmentally concerned who are prone to invoking hell to convey the current state of things. When Donald Trump, during his downbeat inaugural address, conjured an American carnage that left rusted out factories scattered like tombstones across the landscape of our nation, and crime and gangs and drugs that have stolen too many lives and robbed our country of so much unrealized potential, what was he describing but a national apocalypse, a Hades in Chicago and at the border? Our ancestors developed their ideas of hell by drawing on the pains and the deprivations that they knew on earth. Those imaginings shaped our understanding of life before death, too. They still do. The afterlife is an old room in the house of the human imagination, and the ancients loved to offer the tour. Homer has Odysseus sail through the underworld in search of a way back home to Ithaca, for example. However, the Hades drawn by Homer and later by Virgil in the Aeneid is not quite hell as understood in the post-medieval Christian tradition, but it is one of its ancestors. While all of the dead go to Hades, there are tortures specifically designed and individually designated for those who acted badly while alive. Of course, as in everything Greek and Roman, there's an unanswered question of agency. Just who has done the sorting, and how do we know what this judge has been just? How do we know that this judge has been just? The Book of Hell is determinedly Western and Christian in emphasis. Bruce regards Hades together with Gehenna, where kings of Judah were said to sacrifice children by fire, and Sheol, the place of darkness awaiting all of us according to the Hebrew Bible, as the forerunners of Christianity's fire and brimstone. He briefly acknowledges the older and vaguer pagan visions found in ancient Egypt and Mesopotamia. Islam's place of punishment, however, doesn't appear in the book at all. Belief in an old-fashioned, everlasting hell hasn't gone away. Just ask the pastor at most local churches, or the subway preacher with his brimstone-heavy pamphlets. But hell has long been assailed as one of Christianity's cruder means of maintaining control, and some spiritual leaders, intent on presenting a less vengeful God, have attempted to soften or, in some cases, to abolish hell, mostly to the anger and the anxiety of their co-religionists. Earlier this year, Pope Francis had one of his periodic chats with Eugenio Scalfari, the 94-year-old atheist Italian journalist. Scalfari, who takes no notes during his dialogues with the Holy Father, came away from the session with a blockbuster quote. A hell doesn't exist, Francis supposedly said, and wayward souls are annihilated, poof, instead of languishing forever. The Vatican denied that the Pope had said such anything, but it didn't seem entirely out of his character. The great theme of Francis's pontificate is his emphasis on mercy over judgment. More to the point, he has already made it his business to clarify that hell, properly understood, is less a place than a state, namely the state of remoteness from the love of God, an inevitable downside of the gift of free will. Here he echoes C.S. Lewis, who considered hell a choice. The doors of hell, Lewis wrote, are locked on the inside. St. Thomas Aquinas argued the opposite half a century before Dante got to work. In the Summa Theologica, his grand synthesis of Aristotelian philosophy and Christian teaching, he defended the doctrine of hell and insisted that we should think of it as a benefit, not a bug. Not only does hell exist, Aquinas reasoned, but those blessed souls who make it to heaven must be able, by some miracle of cosmic surveillance, the worst and longest season of Big Brother, to see and delight in the fate of hell's inhabitants. Because God's punishments are unimpeachably correct, the lower regions must serve as part of the heavenly vista, the top floor view of all that's right and just. Quote, in order that the happiness of the saints may be more delightful to them and that they may render greater thanks to God for it, they are allowed to see perfectly the suffering of the damned, Aquinas writes. Awful, I know, but think of our own justice system and also of the various means by which we now claim access to the missteps of our fellow citizens. Tax liens, criminal records, mugshots, bad status updates, screenshotted or automatically archived. Think of the camera in the courtroom. Think, too, of those Americans for whom even the mildest criticism of the police constitutes a kind of heresy. It might be helpful to regard them as secular Thomas, who, displaying a certain imaginative immiseration, think of a free and ordinary life in the way that their ancestors once thought of perfect blessedness in heaven. The reward wouldn't be so sweet or perhaps worth having at all if the process that assured it were shown to be a sham. Origen, the scholar and church father, born late in the 2nd century A.D., tended to believe that, in the end, all would be spared. His more famous successor, Augustine of Hippo, fiercely opposed the idea, and he won the long-term doctrinal battle. Almost 2,000 years later, the Swiss theologian Hans Urs von Balthasar hedged the matter ever so slightly, arguing in the aptly titled book, Dare We Hope That All Men Be Saved?, that while we can't be certain that hell is empty, or at least very lightly populated, like a sweltering suburb subject to an infernal sprawl, it might be appropriate to hope or even suspect that it is. More recently, the bishop and gospel singer Carlton Pearson, whose acclaim in Pentecostal and evangelical circles brought him into acquaintance with Presidents George W. Bush and Bill Clinton, proclaimed that he no longer believed in everlasting separation from God. The genocide in Rwanda, he said, had left him unable to fathom that all those innocent, murdered non-Christians would burn. Pearson was roundly denounced and shunned, as thoroughly excommunicated as any Protestant can be. Now, as a kind of a guru entrepreneur, he calls himself a metacostal, preaching, quote, expanded consciousness, radically inclusive love, and self-actualization, end quote. There's a movie about him on Netflix starring Chiwetel Ejiofor, which portrays him as a hero battling a blinkered, punitive church. I admire the Universalists, but only to a point. I still worry more about the hell within than the one that might or might not offer me a place to stay later on. Mostly, though, I come back to Dorothy Day's questions. Why are some people caught and not others? Why do the least of these keep catching hell while the richest and most powerful slide through life unaccosted and unaccountable, leaving God knows what in their wake? There's a cruel paradox at work. The more secular our representations of hell become, the more the poor and rejected and otherwise undesirable tend to populate it. The moral meaning's gone wrong, it seems. However grotesque, the child detainment centers at the U.S.-Mexico border are not hell, but the reason for a hell to exist, so that those responsible for them can one day get their deserts. Karma, within the confines of a lifespan, sounds great, but looks false. So often, the wicked seem to be doing just fine. For all the barbarism of hell, as it is traditionally taught, its ludicrous time frame, its unfair and somewhat bigoted emissions policy, at least some of the right people turn up in it. What recourse is there, real or just hope for, without it? Our most energetic recent social movements, Occupy, hashtag MeToo, Black Lives Matters, have retribution in mind. Bad bankers, sexual aggressors, killer cops. Let's see them finally get their due. But satisfaction arrives slowly, if at all. The bad guys are back on stage, back at their desks, back on the beat. Those movements sometimes seem to clash in spirit with another growing concern, prison abolitionism, which might be thought of as a kind of secular universalism. The movement's strongest moral argument is that the conflation of justice and punishment merely adds more pain to the cruelty already at work in the world. Could we imagine a new justice characterized more by mercy than by threat of the pit? To redirect our creativity and train it toward heaven, and by extension our notions of the good life on earth, would require a kind of revolution in our thinking. As the Book of Hell illustrates again and again, we have afforded lavish attention to the specifics of punishment and left heaven woefully undersketched. Perhaps the sublime is so far beyond our comprehension as to leave us inarticulate, incapable of rendering its details. Or maybe we're just daunted by the implications. It might be time to heed the prophet Isaiah and set the captives free. Well, we've run out of time for today's broadcast. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Today's broadcast and all previous New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Well, that's it for today. Until next time, this is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.